Okay, thank you so much, Orly, and thank you everybody who's here. It's been quite the journey, and I feel very privileged that we got to do it together. And let's delve right in. Like Orly suggested, please write questions and comments in the chat because we have so much to cover today. I don't know how much I'll be able to stop in the middle, but I'll make extra time at the end for responding and discussing your questions. So let's recoup for a second. We finished last week's on a very high note. We finished on the note of King David ruling over a united kingdom, bringing the ark that was lost early in Shoftim, to his capital city in Jerusalem. We watched the end of competition from the house of Shaul. And in a sense, the moment where David became the undisputed, accepted, beloved, very beloved by the people. We saw them dancing with him in the streets, King of Israel. Now, if this was a Hollywood movie, classic Hollywood, not today's more dark, explorative things, but classic Hollywood or classic Disney, if you would, movie, this would have been the end because this is the happy ending. We started in the beginning of Judges with two big problems: the problem of leadership of the or lack thereof, where people are not, where every now and then you would have a leader who could stand up and fight for the people, but overall, the sense was that the people were left like a flock without a shepherd. Nobody was there consistently to take care of them. And also the problem of unity, where each tribe fought their own wars, sometimes one against the other. And without this cohesive, how should I put it, without those two things that tie people together, a strong leadership, dynastic preferably, or at least orderly, centralized, that passes from generation to generation and allows people a strong protection and also a connection to the covenant. A big part of the problem was that people kept forgetting the covenant and forgetting God. So without that kind of continuity and without this kind of unity of a nation working together, they couldn't really stand against the nations around them. They couldn't really withstand the temptation of idolatry, and they couldn't really strive together for something beyond survival. What they could hope for was survival. Thriving was a totally different and unapproachable dream. And then here we have the solution to these problems. Finally, after all the travails of the judges, after civil wars, after problems, after rapes and women being cut into pieces, and then Shmuel, and then Shaul, and then the tension between Shaul and David, finally, we reach the happy crescendo of leadership and unity combined. We have King David, a strong king, and everybody accepts him. Hooray, hooray. Of course, the Hebrew Bible is not a Hollywood or Disney movie, and this is not where the story ends. Instead, there's a turning point. Instead of finishing on this high note and saying, okay, we solved the problems of the judges, we watch everything plunge back into problems, difficulties, challenges, and deep questions about the validity of such a happy ending, i.e., a king, as a solution for the problem of the judges. The first inkling we get that there's a turning point, that things are not perfect in David's rule and under David's control, is a very subtle one. David, in the moment of his victory, surrounded by his people feeling successful, wants to build a home for God. He wants to build the temple. And God tells him no. God tells him, you can't do it. Your son has to do it. This is a little bit of a setback. It's definitely a disappointment for King David, as we see, by the way, in the Psalms. In the Psalms, he keeps talking about his desire for God's home and to be close to God through God's home. But it's not devastating. If anything, we can look at it and say, okay, this hints to us that the missing piece to say this is a truly happy ending is we need not only David, we need to see that David's kingdom passes on to the next generation successfully. Because after all, we already had a king, King Shaul. The problem was that the dynastic process of passing his kingdom forward was disrupted. So we can say, okay, fine, here God tells David, your son will build the temple. In a sense, it's a positive message. It's not a negative message. It means that there will be a son who will be favored by God, who will continue David's work, and we will watch the prosperity and success that David brought into the story pass on into a happily ever after kind of epitaph. So that's a subtle point that could be interpreted negatively or positively. The next turning point, the moment where everything really does go downhill, isn't subtle at all. And it happens immediately after David finishes winning all the wars within Israel and uniting everybody and bringing the ark. Because what we watch here is sin. What we watch here is King David failing. Not merely being told, okay, but your son will build the temple, but being told you did wrong and doing wrong. Let's look at King David's, King David's actions together. I'm opening the source sheet here. And of course, I'm talking about the famous case of David and Bathsheba. Let's read it together. At the turn of the year, the season when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab, with his general, with his officers, and all Israel with him. And they devastated Amnon and besieged Rabbah. Rabbah was a capital city of Ammon in Transjordan. David remained in Jerusalem. In Hebrew, it's not remained, it's set, yoshev, sitting down. Late one afternoon, David rose from his couch and strolled on the roof of the royal palace. And from the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. Uh-oh. And the king sent someone to make inquiries about the woman. He reported, she is Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam and wife of Uriah the Hittite. As we will find out very soon, Uriah was one of David's officers out to war in Rabbah, which means that this beautiful woman is home alone without her husband. David sent messengers to fetch her. She came to him and he lay with her. She had just purified herself after a period and she went back home. The woman conceived and she sent word to David, I am pregnant. Thereupon, David sent a message to Joab, sent Uriah the Hittite to me, and Joab sent Uriah to David. At this point, when Uriah comes to the palace, David tries to get Uriah to go home. He wants to pass off the baby as Uriah's legitimate son or daughter. So he tries to get Uriah to be with Bathsheba so that to cover up his own transgression. But Uriah refuses. Uriah comes, Uriah talks to him, and then refuses to go home. Even when the king tells him to go home, he just lies down on the street. He camps out on the streets of Ir David, on the city of David. And when David asks him, why don't you go home? Uriah answers the following. The ark and Israel and Judah are located at Sukkot. And my master Joab and your majesty's men are camped in the open. How can I go home and eat and drink and sleep with my wife? As you live, by your very life, I will not do this. David tries again. It doesn't work out. And then he changes course. He comes up with another plan to cover up his crime, his transgression. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab, which he sent with Uriah. The letter tells Joab to make sure that Uriah dies in battle, to put him in the place where he will be dead, will be killed for sure. And it takes place and Joab sends words to David. And then when Uriah's wife heard that her husband Uriah was dead, she lamented over her husband. After the period of mourning was over, David sent and had her brought into his palace. She became his wife and she bore him a son. But the Lord was displeased with what David had done. Within 27 verses, we didn't read all of them, we did skip some of them, the text packs a powerful punch. It takes King David, the man we rooted for, the underdog, the boy who fought against the giant, the man we saw growing in popularity and success, the man we, not alone, but everybody who met him fell a little bit in love with. It takes him and has him callously, without too much hesitation, just take somebody else's life and then use murder to cover it up. This is a huge blow and a huge turning point. And it's the turning point of more than one narrative arc in the broad narrative that we're following from the beginning of Shifting. On the most basic level, first, it's a turning point in David's personal story. Until this point, all portrayals of David were very positive. And in fact, the text went to a great effort to keep emphasizing that both the people and God loved and supported and agreed with, were in agreement with David. This is the first time we're seeing David acting in a way that displeases God explicitly and that is ugly for us, that is off-putting for us as readers. But it's not just a turning point in particularly in David's story. It's a turning point in the other broad thematic arcs that we've been following from the beginning of the Judges. Because from the beginning of the book of Judges, as I said before, one of the main problems we've been following is a problem of leadership. Let's look at it together again. I'm in box two. In the very beginning of Judges, the first verses are, after the death of Joshua, the Israelites inquired of the Lord, which of us shall be the first to go up against the Canaanites and attack them? The Lord replied, let the tribe of Yehudah go up. I now deliver the land into their hands. And I'm reminding you of what we discussed in the very first class. Instead of taking this to mean, oh, we should lead the people in this war, the tribe of Yehudah takes it to mean, oh, we should conquer our own land, and then everything else is for everybody else to figure out. Already there's a certain abdication of leadership. And it's poignant that it's the tribe of Yehudah that abdicates leadership, because later David, of course, will be from that tribe. David, the leader par excellence, is coming to redeem or correct this error, this basic foundational error from the beginning of the Judges era. Later, as we read through Judges and through Shmuel, we saw that often what it takes for leadership to be effective, and the text reminds us of that over and over again in many ways, is a certain dynamism. I'm reminding you of the beginning of Shmuel. After they had eaten and drunk at Shiloh, and we're talking here about Chana the bear and Chana and her family, Chana rose. The priest Eli was sitting on the seat near the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. And we had this whole confrontation where she prays and Eli tells her off and eventually understands that she's not in fact drunk and rambling or hysterical, but rather praying to God. And we saw that the fate of these two families, Chana's and Eli, in a sense represents where dynamism leads versus where passivity leads. Because Eli, who is sitting down, who is trying to preserve the status quo, who is passive when it comes to rebuking his sons for exploiting their position, his house falls. His house cannot unite the people. Whereas Chana and afterwards Shmuel, her famous son, who are active, who are dynamic, who break through the status quo and say, no, we want things to be better, they lead to the reunification of the people, to victory against the Plishtim, and eventually to the anointment of the kings. So when we understand that there's a certain trajectory here of learning what leadership means and seeing that leadership means taking action, taking initiative, not sitting down when other people act, but rather rising like Chana and walking like Shmuel, we're told, is walking and traveling to judge the people. In light of that, King David's sudden passivity, and I'll show you what I mean in a second, in this scene is very striking. Because what do we see here? We see a king who, while his people, if you look again at verse one here in the first box, while his people, all his people and his tribe and his general are out making war, he, Yoshev, sits down in Jerusalem. Just like Eli used to sit on the threshold, David is sitting. And then we watch a text where the leitmotif, the word that repeats itself over and over and over again throughout the chapter, is the word, the root shalach, the root for sanding. David sends messengers. Bathsheba sends messengers. David sends a letter. Uriah is sent to him. Send, 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 send. As if to emphasize to us that there's a certain removal here between David and action. Instead of doing things himself, he sends. He uses messengers. He uses letters. It's almost as if the text is trying to hammer it into us, to draw our attention very forcefully to the fact that David here is not the David who once upon a time took five rocks and threw them on a giant when nobody else dared. He's a man who's sitting back and letting other people run around do his will. He lost that dynamism, that initiative, that activism that was his trademark trait. And this puts in question, in a sense, it raises the question whether he is, in fact, the answer to the questions of leadership that have been haunting us from the Judges era. Can this king, who at this crucial point, after he won and after he succeeded and after he united everybody, loses his ability to take initiative and make things happen, can this man represent the answer to this problem, or is he going to become a new problem like Eli and his household were before him? Which leads us to another arc, narrative arc, that this turns on its head. Until now, in the entire narrative arc that started when the people approached Shmuel and asked for kingship, the story focused on one of the two problems that Shmuel and God raised at that point. Let me go back, rewind a little bit, and remind you that when the people come to Shmuel and say, "We want a king," Shmuel answers with two warnings. One warning is that a king is not going to solve their problems because a king is only going to succeed if he remains God's servant. The other problem was that the king will take advantage of them, that they need to be aware that a king will exploit his position. So far, the story only dealt, in a sense, with the first problem. We kept first with the rise of Shaul, then with his rejection, then by the way the story kept drawing comparison, or more accurately, contrasts between Shaul and David. It was constantly deliberating over the question, what kind of king do we need that will remember to be God's servant? Shaul wasn't enough of God's servant to succeed at remaining king and leaving a legacy behind him. David comes in as a solution to this problem. But Shmuel's problem, Shmuel's warning about how the king will exploit the people and take their daughters and sons and take their produce and take, we didn't see that happen too much until now. I assume you know Chekhov's famous saying that if in theater you see a gun in a drawer or on the counter in the first act, you're guaranteed that this gun will shoot by the last one. So it's as if Shmuel's warning was left there as a smoking gun waiting to shoot. What does it mean that the king will exploit the people and take advantage of them? Well, it shoots here. Now we see what it means. We see a king who takes another man's wife and then arranges that other man's death. In an aside, I want to point out that the sages were very uncomfortable with calling this a sin. There's a very long and famous passage in the Talmud, in the Gemara, where the sages are trying to present or explain away the sinfulness of what David does here. I don't want to get into the question of definitions of sin, because this really has more to do with the sages than with the narrative, which is what we're focusing on. I just want to say that regardless of whether you're technically calling it a sin or not, there's no question that the text itself, the words, the wording, the way it's described, is negative. It's not flattering for David. It's not trying to present it as an innocent moment of passion. It's the whole sending a messenger doesn't only emphasize the fact that he's not doing things directly, he's not active anymore. It also emphasizes the fact that there was a lot of time for him to think about things and realize this is wrong. It extends, it makes present for us the passage of time between the moment when David sees her to the moment until he has her, and between the moment when he realizes he's pregnant until the moment he decides to bring about Uriah's death. There's a lot of messenger time going on there when he could have taken a step back and changed course, and he didn't. Okay, so we have this turning point. David himself changes, or our view of him changes. Our sense that perhaps David represents a solution through his unique dynamism and taking action and initiative all the time to the problem of leadership is called into question. And our exploration of what kingship means is now inclusive of the horror of exploitation that it can bring into people's life. It includes that. That's what I mean. It reveals to us that facet. Once again, calling into question the idea that somehow a king should be the problem, should be the solution to the problems that's been hunting us from the Judges onwards. Where does it leave us? If this was a tragedy story, a classic tragedy in the Shakespearean sense, maybe that would have been the end. Or, you know, David sinned, nobody's perfect, the world is an unhappy place where shining moments are far and in far in between. How do you say that? Far and few? Few and far in between.
Few and far between.
Thank you. Few and far between. But this is not where the story ends. The story goes on to explore in rather excruciating detail what passivity, as opposed to dynamism, can mean to the two problems we have been discussing from the very beginning, from the era of the Judges, namely the problem of continuity, either in leadership or in observance of the covenant, how to connect one generation to the next and build something that continues and goes on, and the problem of unity, of how to get all those different scattered parts of the people and get them to work together. We thought David solved those problems, but the second David becomes passive, the second he stops actively pursuing change and shaping the reality around him, both of those problems raise their heads again. Because what happens after the whole sin with Bathsheba, what happens immediately after, is that we are introduced, and I'm going to pause here and say that what happens first is that God sends the prophet Nathan to rebuke David, and we will discuss that later. We'll come back to that point later. But what happens after the sin and after the rebuke is we're introduced to David's children. The hope, right? The dynastic hope of the people who are supposed to continue his legacy and turn his achievements into something lasting, of the sort that Shaul wasn't able to achieve. And what's the first thing we see? We see one of his sons, Amnon, rape his daughter, Tamar. We're not going to read this in detail. We don't have time to do that, even though it's a very powerful chapter and deserves to be learned at length and detail. What interests me now, though, is less the horror of what Amnon does when he rapes his sister and then tosses her out like yesterday's trash, and more what happens afterwards, how David responds, or more to the point, how he doesn't respond. Because just as David exhibited a certain passivity by staying home and not going to war right before sinning with Bathsheba, David exhibits a startling passivity in his response to his own daughter's rape. Let's look at it together. Just can I ask that everybody mute themselves? Thank you. I'm in box 3, and I am reading the responses of two men to the rape. One is of Shalom, who is a full brother of Tamar. He's another son of David who shares a mother also with Tamar. Amnon is the son of a different queen. Her brother Avshalom said to her, "Was it your brother Amnon who did this to you? For the present, sister, keep quiet about it. He is your brother. Don't brood over the matter." And Tamar remained in her brother's Avshalom's house forlorn. When King David had heard about all this, he was greatly upset. let's pause here for a second. In the Hebrew Bible, we don't usually hear about emotions without hearing about the action that follows. The Hebrew Bible is not interested in emotions per se. It's not a stream of consciousness novel from the early 20th century. It's not the interest here. It's not the point. When we hear about emotions, about feelings, about experiences, it's almost always in relation to the actions that have to do with it, the corresponding actions. So we hear when King David heard about this, he was greatly upset. And if you're used to that pattern of the Hebrew Bible of emotion being followed by action, it feels like there should be an action here. But it stops. The verse stops. It doesn't do anything. It's a glaring omission, especially following on the previous verse, in the heels of the previous verse, where we heard Avshalom talking and talking and talking at length, giving a fairly long speech in terms of the Hebrew Bible to his brother, to his sister, and talking to her and involving himself. And then in contrast, all we see is that David is angry and we never hear what he does about it. And as if to emphasize it, the story goes back to Avshalom to talk about him again. Avshalom didn't utter a word to Amnon, good or bad, but Avshalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar. In between these two responses of Avshalom in verse 20 and in verse 22, all we hear of King David is that he's angry. This passivity, this moment of not taking action, costs David dearly. Because maybe if David has taken action, Avshalom would have let it go. If David had punished Amnon in some way, Avshalom wouldn't have taken the action that he takes in the following chapter. What happens in the following chapter is that Avshalom, after waiting for 2 years, revenge is a dish best served very, very frigid in his case. After everybody forgets and assumes that he forgot as well about his sister, right? Arranges a situation where Amnon is under his power and murders him. And that leads both to heartbreak on David's side and exile for Avshalom, because he has to run away, so he's not punished for this murder. And this once again causes heartbreak to David, who loved Avshalom dearly. So we see that David's passivity in this case cost him by losing him both of these sons, in a sense. Of course, this is not the end of the Avshalom story. What follows is that David, even though he craves his son Avshalom, wants him to come back, misses him, does nothing. Once again, continuing his stance of passivity, his stance of not being dynamic about pursuing the affairs of his children, or managing his relationship with his children. And Yoav is the one that takes action. Yoav, the general, creates a whole conversation. And again, we can't go into this now. We don't have enough time, but he creates a whole decoy situation. He gets a woman to go and talk to David as if she's talking about something else, and then tell him, oh, it's actually relevant for what you're saying here about your son, goading David into agreeing to bringing Avshalom back. But even then, David is still passive. He allows Avshalom to come back to Jerusalem, but he doesn't invite him to court. He refuses to see him. He keeps his distance. And this distance is corrected by Avshalom's initiative. Avshalom first tries to talk to Yoav to get him to talk to the king on his behalf. Then, to get Yoav's attention, burns Yoav's fields to get Yoav to come and talk to him. And only when Yoav agrees and goes and talks to the king does the king bring back his son Avshalom into the court. All this time of keeping Avshalom far away and distant and not initiating reconciliation leads to what happens next. And what happens next is devastating. Avshalom, deciding that he has no future under David, decides to take the kingdom by force. And he starts collecting supporters. He sits at the gates of the city, and when people come to judgment first of all, impresses them with his great beauty, gives them gifts, and tells them, oh, my father, yeah, well, you're going to judgment for him. I wish I could judge you. I would give you a better, I would give you a better deal. I would give you a better resolution. Slowly stealing the hearts of the people, drawing them to him and away from his father, and eventually going to Hebron and declaring himself king. It's a very symbolic act because David was first crowned, first made king of a group of people in Hebron. So when Avshalom goes there and makes himself king, he's following in his father's footsteps, in a sense saying, the legacy that my father created should be mine. I am the new incarnation of what was best about David, the beauty, the belovedness, the charisma, taking initiative, talking to the people. Him, he's sitting there in the palace, not taking initiative, not doing anything. You should choose me. And here I want to pause. I want to pause and rewind a little bit and show that we talked about how the David's sin turns the plot in two senses. In the sense that we see him losing his dynamism, losing his initiative, but also in the sense that we're starting to explore the exploitative nature of kingship. Interestingly, in this whole arc of stories, from Amnon's rape of his sister to Avshalom's exile and return, and eventually to Avshalom's rebellion against his own father, we're watching both the effects of the passivity that David displays, and we're watching the exploitative, toxic aspects of kingship through his children's actions. David himself is not acting in particularly exploitative ways here. He's just being passive. But his passivity allows his children to take advantage of their position. It invites Amnon to rape his sister as if he is entitled to it. It invites Avshalom to use his power for killing. And eventually it invites Avshalom to start a rebellion, march all the way to Jerusalem, from which David and his supporters run away, and rape his father's concubines on the roof in plain sight of the people to prove that he is virile, that he is the man, that he is the ruler now. This is not the kind of kingship Shmuel would have wanted the people to experience. And yet this is what happened. And we see the idea that David can pass on the kingship peacefully and create continuity collapse when his son rebels against him. And the idea that the people are united behind their king collapse when Avshalom successfully embroils the people in civil war. These two strands, the loss of continuity and the loss of unity, come to a head in the decisive battle between David and Avshalom. Spoiler alert, David wins. But the way he wins is very, very interesting. Let's look at it together. I am going to jump a little bit ahead to box number 4. We're talking about the beginning of the final battle, the decisive battle between David and Avshalom in Shmuel Bet, the second book of Shmuel, chapter 18. David mustered the troops who were with him and set over them captains of thousands and captains of hundreds. David sent out the troops, one third under the command of Yoav, one third under the command of Yoav's brother Abishai, son of Tzruiah, and one third under the command of Ittai the Gittit. And David said to the troops, I myself will march with you. Unlike in that time when they all marched to Ammon and he stayed behind to look at beautiful women on roofs. But the troops replied, no, for if some of us flee, the rest will not be concerned about us. Even if half of us should die, the others will not be concerned about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, it is better for you to support us from the town. And the king said to them, I will do whatever you think best. He is abdicating his decision here. He's letting them decide for him. Does that remind you of anything? To me, it resonates with Shaul acting upon the people's wishes in ways that will later cost him God's favor. So the king stood beside the gate as all the troops marched out by their hundreds and thousands. And the king gave orders to Yoav Avishai and Ittai, deal gently with my boy Avshalom for my sake. He calls him boy, Na'a, even though Avshalom is an adult who made many, many horrific choices, raped his father's concubines, embroiled the people in the civil war that will kill them by the thousands. For David, he's still his boy. He is his Na'a, his child. And the king thinks that they can defend him. The king thinks that his will can defend Avshalom regardless of what happened. But what David is about to see is that when you surrender your initiative, when you're no longer actively leading the people, the outcome is out of your hands. Because despite the king's explicit orders, orders that the troops all heard, I'm here at verse 5, all the troops heard the king give the order about Avshalom to the officers. When the moment comes that Avshalom runs away from battle, and very poetically, his hair, his beautiful hair that was a point of great pride for him, gets caught in a tree and he gets stuck there. His mount runs away and he's hanging there between earth and sky, vulnerable. And Yoav hears about it. Yoav doesn't follow the king's order. Instead, Yoav, in verse 14, takes three darts in his hand and drove them into Avshalom's chest. Avshalom was still alive in the thick growth of the terebinth when 10 of Yoav's young arm bearers closed in and struck at Avshalom until he died. Then Yoav sounded the horn and the troops gave up their pursuit of the Israelites, for Yoav held the troops in check. It's interesting that the translation here calls it, he held the troops in check. In Hebrew, chasach Yoav et ha'am, could mean also that he wanted to spare the people. Yoav sees that this is civil war, that what we're watching here, the two camps fighting each other, should all be subjects of David, brothers to each other. So as soon as he can stop the war because he killed their leader, he stops it. He has no interest in continuing it. In the meantime, David is still in the town waiting for news, hoping that his son is okay. And he sits there, I'm in verse 24, David was sitting between the two gates. The watchman on the roof of the gate walked over to the city wall. He looked up and saw a man running alone. This is a man that carries the news of the death of Avshalom and the victory. Before we continue with this painful narrative and David's painful response when he cries, my son, Avshalom, my son, bni, Avshalom. Before we talk about, we don't have time, but before we talk about the interesting dynamic between Yoav and David surrounding this entire event, I want to point out that the way the story is structured here is reminiscent of a very, very, very old biblical scene. And I'm talking about the Akedah, the binding of Yitzchak. There too, we see a father and a son. The father has to cause damage to his son. And he sees an animal whose horns are held in the bushes, a eyal. And he kills the animal instead. Here we see a son, a father, heading for war, to war against his son, hoping that he can avoid killing him, just like Abraham must have hoped to avoid killing Yitzchak. But when you're not the one holding the knife, you don't get to make this decision. When you defer the power in this situation to someone else, you don't get to be the Avraham who kills someone else instead. You don't get to. Instead, he sits there between the gate. And I want to point out again that what he does there is sitting. The very same thing that Eli did, the very same thing that David did right before sinning with Bathsheba. Once again, we see that when someone sits down, they give up on their power in the situation. After the horrible loss, after the people reunite around David, another civil war starts. And once again, David wins with Yoav's help and gathers all the people. And the story continues, but we are left with two main question marks about the whole idea of kingship as a desirable thing. We're left wondering whether David is even capable, whether anyone is capable of being the kind of dynamic leader that we needed from the beginning of the judges era. Because if David, who started as the most dynamic man of all, can lead to such devastation, both to his own family and to the entire people, by becoming passive, what's to tell us that that's not going to happen over and over and over again with his descendants? If David can't manage our relationship with his children successfully, what's to guarantee to us, what's to promise us that he will successfully pass the kingship forward, solving the problem of continuity that haunted us from the beginning of the judges? And if even in David's day, we watch two civil wars, and this is after the civil war with Shaul's descendants. This is after Shaul's house has already become irrelevant as a threat to him. Who's to tell us that the problem of disunity we watched from the beginning of the judges can be solved by a king? But the story doesn't end here, and it doesn't only offer us serious and probing questions, it also offers us silver linings. And specifically, I want to talk about two. The first silver lining is what happens immediately after David's sin, and after the prophet Nathan comes to him to rebuke him in God's name. What David does in that scene, when Nathan tells him, "You are a sinner, you sinned," is especially startling when we consider what Shaul did in similar situations. Let's rewind for a moment. When Shmuel, the prophet, came to Shaul and confronted him, time and time again, Shaul said, "But the people, but I meant well, but he couldn't face his responsibility. This is not what David does. Let's look at it. We are in box number 5. I'm going to jump ahead, though, to verse 13. Immediately when Nathan, the prophet, finishes his strong speech calling David out, David says, "I stand guilty before the Lord." Or in Hebrew, "Chatati Lashem." Two powerful words. He immediately accepts responsibility. And God immediately telegraphs or lets us know that he approves of such action, of taking responsibility, because the next statement within the same verse, "And Nathan replied to David, 'The Lord has remitted your sin, you shall not die.'" What Nathan tells David is that he's going to pay. He's going to pay dearly. And in a sense, everything that follows, the trouble with Amnon and Tamar, the trouble with Avshalom, the rebellion, the rape of the concubines, Avshalom dies, is the punishment. Or you could say the natural consequence in one sense, because this is what comes out of passivity. You could also say that perhaps Amnon, raping his sister, thought it was legitimate because he saw his father take another woman. We don't know. We're not given much insight into Amnon's mind, but it's definitely a consequence of these events. And yet, despite these punishments, these heavy, heavy punishments, God says, "You shall not die, and your dynasty shall continue." What happened to Shaul, that upon sinning, God said, "Okay, you're not going to continue. Your children are not going to be kings after you," is not happening to David. Somehow the fact that he can take responsibility for his sin while not making it okay and while not changing the fact that Uriah is dead, nothing can bring him back from death, does mean something, does change something in God's perception of him and in his suitability to still remain the king and remain the dynasty. We have to ask ourselves why. Why is it so important that a king takes responsibility and says, "I sinned"? I mean, there's something beautiful about it, that he's not so lost to corruption that he just says, "Oh, but I'm the king, I'm entitled, why can't I do that?" But rather recognize that he was wrong. There's something powerful about it on a personal level. We see plenty of people in positions of power becoming incapable of saying that. But why is that enough to make him suitable for kingship? What bearing does it have on the big questions we're discussing of the kingship as a solution to the problem of the judges? I want to leave this question open. We'll come back to it in a minute. And I want to talk about the next silver lining. The next silver lining happens in the very last chapter of Shmuel. at the end, at the evening of David's life. God gives David a bad idea on purpose. God as a punishment, as a goad to him. He inspires David to count the people. And David asks Yoav to go out and count all of Israel. And Yoav says, you're not allowed to do that. You're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to just count people. Whenever people are supposed to be counted in the Hebrew Bible, there's all kinds of methods for counting that don't just diminish people into numbers on a list. You count families, people bring a certain amount of money, and that becomes counted. There's all kinds of solutions, but you're not supposed to count people. And yet that's what David wants. He wants to count the people. Eventually, Yoav, right-hand man that he is, sets out and fulfills the king's demands. And David regrets it. Immediately, he realizes he shouldn't have done it. He realizes that he has sinned. But it's too late. What happened already happened. And here is what happens afterwards. I'm in box number 6 and verse 10. But afterward, David reproached himself for having numbered the people. And David said to the Lord, I have sinned grievously in what I have done. Again, we see him being able to say, I did wrong. Please, O Lord, remit the guilt of your servant, for I have acted foolishly. When David rose in the morning, the word of the Lord had come to the prophet God, David's seer. Go and tell David, thus said the Lord, I hold 3 things over you. Choose one of them and I will bring it upon you. God came to David and told him. He asked, shall a 7-year famine come upon you in the land? Or shall you be in flight from your adversaries for 3 months while they pursue you? Or shall there be 3 days of pestilence in your land? Now consider carefully what reply I shall take back to him who sent me. David said to God, I am in great distress. The truth is that that's not exactly what he says. What he says in Hebrew is tzar li me'od, which means it's very narrow for me. It's more like I am in dire straits. Everything is collapsing against me. Let us fall into the hands of the Lord, for his compassion is great, and let me not fall into the hands of men. He chose pestilence. And here I want to pause. On the surface, we once again see David's sin and accept the punishment with some nobility of spirit, you know, saying, okay, I sinned, I accept, I'm not going to argue against it. But we also see an instance of passivity. We see a man who, when he's told that there's these punishments, he accepts it. We're seeing a repentant version of this man, but we're not seeing the King David who went, and when people told him, you can't fight a giant, said, no, yes, I can. Or the King David who, when people told him, you can't run away from Sheol, said, yes, I can. We see a man who accepts his fate, except that when David actually sees it happening, he rejects it. I'm reading here at verse 17. When David saw the angel who was striking down the people, he said to the Lord, I alone am guilty. I alone have done wrong, but these poor sheep, what have they done? Let your hand fall upon me and my father's house. With this statement, we're watching once again the awakening shepherd. David stepped onto the stage as a shepherd. When he fought against Goliath, he told the king, Shaul, that he will fight against him and succeed, just like he succeeded in his work as a shepherd when beasts were threatening his flock, because God will help him. And once again, he is awakened to his role as the shepherd of the people and is willing to sacrifice himself in their stead. Furthermore, when, after saying that he is in dire straits and the world is collapsing on him and there's no way out, he stands up and demands a way out from God, he also marks himself as the spiritual heir of Hana. Remember Hana, barren Hana in the beginning of the book of Shmuel, whose husband tells her, oh, why be sad? Aren't I better to you from sons? And whom Eli told, what are you doing, you crazy woman? Why are you rumbling here? Are you drunk? Go away and sober up somewhere else. Said, no, I refuse to accept the state of affairs as it stands now, where I am barren and can't have children. I refuse. I reject it. I will ask God to change his will. Because what is barrenness if not a physical expression of God's will in the worldview of the Bible? I refuse to accept God's will. I will ask for appeal. I will appeal. I will demand a change in the rule. Also, David marks himself in this moment as a mirror image of Shaul, because at the very end of Shaul's life, when he goes to the medium from Endor and revives or calls up Shmuel's spirit, he uses the exact same expression to describe his distress. He says, I'm here below, Shmuel said to Shaul, why have you disturbed me and brought me up? And Shaul answered, I am in great trouble, except in Hebrew he says, Tsar li me'od, I am in dire straits. It's very narrow for me. Except that then when Shmuel tells them, there's nothing to do, you're going to die, and the people are going to die in battle tomorrow, there's nothing I can do, he doesn't pray. He doesn't beg God to change it. He doesn't say, let me die, but save the people. He just accepts. And he nobly goes on and leads them into battle. He's a noble person. He's noble of spirit. He's courageous. He's heroic. But he accepts. David does not accept. David refuses to let the status quo stand. And when he does that, God gives him a way out. It's a very interesting way out. God tells him, go and buy the land of Arvna the Jebusite and build an altar there and bring sacrifices and offerings, and I will stop the pestilence. And David does so, and the pestilence stops, and this piece of land will be the foundation of the temple. And maybe this is a hint for us as to what those two silver linings we just discussed have in common. What does the moment when David says, yes, I have sinned, have in common with the moment when he says, I know, God, this is your will, and nevertheless, I am going to ask for a different option. I'm going to break the pattern and say, no, I want something else. What connects both of these moments in David's life, what connects those ideas, the idea of repentance and the idea of refusing to accept God's will as the final judgment or anything else really, is that both of them represent the potential for changing the way things are. When someone repents and does tshuva, returns, we say that God deletes the sins and gives them an opportunity to start fresh. You can outstep the consequences that your sins created for you. And in your soul, in your spirit, I don't mean the consequences in the world. You killed someone, they're dead. Nothing can change that. Nothing can remit that. And I'm thinking of David and Uriah here. But by repentance, you can, in some level, start afresh again. And this is what happened to David when God told him, okay, fine, you're not going to die and your children are still going to be your heirs. The same thing is true of someone who refuses to accept the way things are, but rather says, no, I will find a way to make them different. If you accept the way things are, if you accept the status quo, the future that differs from it cannot be born because you accept the reality as it is. And you can't pursue a future if you do. And so, despite that horrible turning point we started with, despite the passivity David shows later as a father that leads to disunity and a collapse of leadership and dynastic fractures and civil war amongst the people, despite all of that, he is still a man who can change course. And this is extremely important when we're entering the era of the kings. Because all the problems we discussed today, they're real threats. The exploitative potential of kingship. The fact that a king can become so confident that he is the way things are. He is the status quo, but he will take advantage of the people. The fact that a king being a good king does not guarantee that his children and heirs are going to be good kings after him, or that the transfer of power will go on peacefully, or that the people will remain united around the figure at their head. All those problems are real. And when we open the book of Kings, they hit us in the face. Already in Shlomo's life, we're starting to see problems. And in his son's life, in Rehoboam's life, the kingdom fractures into two. The problem of unity is open wide again. And we watch bad leaders rise time and time and time again. And instead of people whose job is to guide the people to remember the covenant, we watch kings who lead the people astray to idolatry. The kings become the problem in many ways. So when we enter this era with all the problems that are already foreshadowed, or better say, hid in or seeded into David's life himself, as we discussed today, we're also given a model of what we need in a king. We can't expect the king to be perfect. Nobody is perfect. Humans are not perfect. But we need the king to be able to correct course, to say, I was wrong, to say, I refuse to accept that this is the sum all of our reality and I will strive for a change. And as long as we have that model, the Davidic model, then even with all the difficulties, it'll inoculate us in a sense against corruption. It's not going to make things perfect. It's not going to make things easy, but it's going to mean that even if things go down, they can go up again. I want to read it in the words of Yoram Chazoni, who wrote a wonderful book called The Philosophy of Hebrew Scripture. And he wrote it very beautifully in his book, where, and I have to give a little bit of a background, where he basically says that the Torah, the Hebrew Bible in general, presents to us two models of leadership. One is associated with the biblical Yehuda and David, and one is associated with Yosef. Yosef is extremely successful, the biblical original Yosef, son of Jacob. But what Yehuda offers is different, because what Yehuda and David offer is the ability to say things need to change. This is the way things are, but we're going to change them. And what he says here in the second quote, I invite you to later read the first quote. It's also beautiful. Ultimately, it is the qualities associated with Yehuda that are vindicated by the narrative as being most suited for ruling over men. And this, despite the fact that Joseph's political ability are recognized to be superior. And here comes the important sentence. The ability of the ruler to humble himself and change his ways is seen as the only hope of correcting the direction of a state when it is off course. And now, let's see it in the words of the Bible themselves. Throughout our journey, we've seen two images hovering, right? The image of someone sitting and someone walking. Sitting is status quo. Sitting is accepting the way things are. Sitting is decay. Sitting is not rebuking your children. Sitting is opening the door for sin and collapse. Walking, dynamism, taking initiative, that's leadership, time and time and time again in the text. And this is what King David tells his son Shlomo before dying. Let's go up here. I'm still in box 7 going up. When David's life was drawing to a close, he instructed his son Solomon as follows. I am going the way of all the earth. Be strong and show yourself a man. Keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways and following his laws, his commandments, his rules, and his admonitions, as recorded in the teachings of Moses, in order that you may succeed in whatever you undertake and wherever you turn. In other words, take seriously Shmuel's warning when he first gave king to the people, when he said the king will only remain a king if he follows God's will. Then the Lord will fulfill the promise that he made concerning me. If your descendants are scrupulous in their conduct and walk before me faithfully with all their heart and soul, your line on the throne of Israel shall never end. The second half of David's life gives us an intimate knowledge of all the different problems inherent in the institution of kingship. But it also gives us the one redeeming possibility, the one way that can redeem it and make it into something that can, in fact, solve the problems of leadership and continuity and unity that have been haunting us from Judges. And that is that trait, the ability to keep walking, to keep being dynamic, to keep striving to make things better than they are, to make what's wrong right. And it is on this note that I want to finish our journey and thank you dearly for being with me from the beginning to this moment. I feel like it's a very powerful moment in Tanakh. because even though there's the tragedies of the era of the kings later, in a sense, we will have the key to understanding those tragedies. As we will follow Kings 1 and Kings 2 in our own reading, in our own learning, we can see how kings who walk succeed in leading the people in a good way, whereas kings who just lie back on their laurels lead to decay all the way down to the Churban, the destruction of the temple, which we just commemorated this week. And may we watch its rebuilding in our ears. May we be worthy. May we walk and be worthy of God. Thank you. And now your questions and comments. I'm going to go back and start responding. If you have anything you want to add, please write it in the chat. Moment. Okay. Just a moment. Okay. Just a moment. Susanna Levine wrote, it is interesting that Uriah is a Chiti, but seems to be attached, for lack of a better word, to the Jewish people whose wife goes to the mikveh. This is an excellent point. There's an interesting thing about David. We didn't have time to see it because it's more in the chapters leading up to what we read today. But you see that part of his victory and uniting the people includes, in a sense, making the other nations living in Israel, those nations that we never successfully got rid of, those were perennial enemies through the era of the judges, making them his subjects too. He has Philistines, not only Hittites, he has Philistines fighting for him as well. And they're loyal to him when Absalom rebels against him. In a sense, it's almost as if he became so powerful, he made the Israelites so powerful, that the ethnic identity of those small groups that still survived within it became irrelevant, and they became mercenaries for the king. Even though, as you pointed out, in this case, it seems that she follows Jewish law. It's not just citizenship. It's more than that. iPad wrote, Re Bathsheba and David and the First Temple. Is one of the reasons that the First Temple destroyed because Solomon built it, i.e. the forbidden sexual relations of his mother and father, which indirectly led to Solomon's birth after his older brother died in infancy. So King David's sin instead are along with the nation's sin. So this is an interesting suggestion. It's hard, I don't know of a reading like that, which of course doesn't mean that you shouldn't consider it. The reason I don't think I agree necessarily with this reading is that throughout the Davidic line, by which I mean his ancestors, not his descendants, there's issues of sexual impropriety. His great-great-great-great-grandmother, right, through Ruth, through Ruth's line, was the daughter of Lot who raped her father. His other great-great-great-great-great-grandmother through Yehudah was Tamar, who was Yehuda's daughter-in-law, pretended to be a prostitute and stole seed to become a mother of Yehuda's children. According to the sages, there's even issues of impropriety in his own parentage and trying to explain, we mentioned it a little bit last time, trying to explain why Ishai ignores him or treats him so coldly, the sages suggest that maybe Ishai suspected his wife of infidelity. And yet clearly all those instances, instead of making us question David, serve to highlight how amazing he is. They serve to highlight that it doesn't matter in a sense that you're coming from that place. What matters is what you do. So it's hard for me to believe that the temple coming from Shlomo is somehow going to break this pattern and be doomed by something that preceded it, instead of proving that even from bad things, something good can come up. But that's my personal opinion here. I'm not familiar with readings that discuss that in particular. Norm Finkelberg asked a very important question for any leadership. And I assume it was in reference to the issue of David sending messengers in the story of Bathsheba. What is the proper balance between dynamism and ability to delegate? It's an excellent question. I am not a political philosopher, so I'm not going to even attempt answering it. I would argue that in this particular case, it's not really ability to delegate. because what we see here is him sending messengers to facilitate him enjoying a forbidden fruit, so to speak. It's not him delegating the tasks of kingship, which we see David do time and time again with his generals, with his many advisors, etc. Judith Schwartz points out that Yaakov was passive when Dinah was raped and her brothers Shimon and Levi act. It's true. And by the way, there's a lot of parallels between that entire story of Amnon raping Tamar and Shechem raping Dinah and the father's responses, and how the father's responses, in a sense, allowed or invited the sons, their sons, to respond with violence they don't approve of. Just a minute. There's an interesting question here about Bathsheba. I'm going to focus on some of them over others, just for time issue reasons. It seems like her bathing was not done modestly if she's bathing on the roof. This is a very interesting question, and there's a lot of discussion about that in rabbinic literature. What does it mean that she's bathing on the roof? Why is she bathing on the roof? Also, if you've ever been or ever will be in the city of David, in the archaeological dig of the city of David, you will see that it's a very steep hill, and the king's palace is clearly on top. So if you're bathing on the roof right below him, it's not exactly a huge surprise that you're seen. Part of why it's very difficult for us to understand the nuance of the situation and whether she was immodest or modest, whether it was she was trying to lure the king or not, is that we don't know enough about the physical culture. We don't know enough about how exactly it was done. It's very possible that this was perfectly normal, that in a household full of people, if a woman wanted to bathe in an appropriate way, the roof, maybe with some hangings around you or something, was the only option. We just don't know. So it's very hard for me to answer the question. Another question is, what came first, David and Melch not being allowed to build the temple or the Bathsheba story? So the answer is him not being able to build the temple. And in the book of Shmuel, the text doesn't elaborate about it, but in Divrei Hayamim, whose name I forgot in English, sorry. Chronicles. Right.
Chronicles.
Thank you. And the Chronicles, they elaborate that God says that a man of war cannot build a temple. A man who killed, even under God's orders, is not the right person to build God's temple. So it's not really related to the Bathsheba story. It's related to David's necessary wars leading up to his rise to power and success.
Do we necessarily have to assume that if she's bathing, we all assume in our heads when that she's bathing, and so we assume a nakedness, but we don't know if you bathed in the sun, it made the water warmer, you know, whatever, but she wasn't necessarily, she was just beautiful. Like, we don't know for sure that's the state she was in.
Like I said, we have a lot of holes. You know, there's a thing about stories that when you tell a story, and we are, after all, in a class about storytelling, so I feel okay going into that for a moment. When you tell a story, you have to assume that there are certain things you and your audience just know, and you can just skip them. You know, if I tell you a story about how I walked into a house and got to the fifth floor, or whatever, I'm not going to go into explain to you how houses are constructed in the 21st century, because I'll assume you know. Of course, when we have ancient stories, we don't know those things that are assumed, and it diminishes our ability to fully understand. No question about that.
Surely when it says mitkadeshet, connecting her...
Will you pass, please?
Sorry?
I'm...
Gershon, what were you saying?
I'm saying surely when it says mitkadeshet, it's implying that she is like Tamar, who pretended to be a kadesha.
It's an interesting question. I'm not sure I agree, because the mitkadeshet comes after he sees her. It's not.
It suggests that she was in fact as responsible for this intercourse as he was. Mm-hmm. It puts a completely different twist to the story.
Maybe
they're partners in crime.
Gershon is raising an interesting question, that there's an interesting point, that there's something about the wording here that implies some responsibility on our part. You can argue it back and forth. It's not, it can also allude to other things. I feel like one word here is a little bit too thin of a support, even though there are other things. Like I said, we have to leave this scene standing as it is. It's a very, obscure moment. It's not also so clear.
Also the hikpa ale of mitkadeshet can also denote pretending to do something. We see that sometimes in biblical verses. The hikpa ale means it's not actually doing something, but just pretending. So mitkadeshet, she was...
What word do you think implies pretense?
The hikpa ale, mitkadeshet, may mean pretend rather than actually doing something.
So I'm not familiar with that.
The mitkadesh can also be the storyteller giving David an excuse. And I think we always have to remember the power that the king, this man in this case, has versus this woman being called in. Before we ascribe guilt to her. I think that's important. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, we have to, like I said, I don't want to go into it beyond this because, like I said, there's a lot of rabbinic and academic readings of this text that are very interesting, of this scene with Bathsheba, that are trying to kind of unpack it because it's so condensed. It's such a condensed scene and it describes such a fall from grace. Such a powerful turning point in David's life, and yet so condensed, so brief, so everything little by little. So we could do a whole course just about that. So I'm going to have to gracefully, concede the floor and say, please feel free to keep thinking about it. And if you want to write to me about it later, you're welcome to. I will write my email in the chat in a moment. Just a minute. Okay. So someone asked asked
a question of... didn't get your email.
I'll write it in a minute. I didn't. Right now, I'm just looking at the questions. I'm trying to make sure that I do justice to all your questions, which is very difficult because it's hard to see them in the chat. It's very challenging for me to see them. But here, I wrote my email now. Please feel free to write to me. No, sorry, wrong email. shar.rachel@gmail.com. The second one is the right one. Feel free to write me. I can't promise to answer promptly, but I will answer. That I do promise, God willing. Somebody asked a question, several people asked the same question of why are we looking up to David so much? Why is it that we're aspiring for Mashiach ben David? Why is it that we always talk about David as the golden standard that everybody should be like when there's in fact so many troubles, so many problems, so many holes in the story. So I hope that to some extent I was able to answer this with the end of the class and the silver linings. But I want to say, and we'll finish on that note, I feel like it's a good place to stop, that in many ways, if we want to understand David's appeal, we have to take a step back. We have to look at him not within this scene or that scene, as we just saw in our discussion here, each scene is very ambiguous and complicated. We have to see him in the bigger picture. And in the bigger picture, David introduces his dynamism, his ability to take responsibility, his ability to change course, his ability to be creative as a leader and not just follow the expectations, but rather find new path, and his ability to combine being a leader of men, a successful leader of men, with being a man whose main relationship and main focus is on God. in all these ways, despite his flaws and despite the problems and despite his mistakes and sins, David leaves us perhaps the only way for kingship to walk the very, very fine line between corruption on the one side and failure on the other, between becoming exploitative institution on the one side and not succeeding at leading the people effectively on the other side. In the whole weird game that we watched, in the whole weird drama we watched of Shaul trying to walk that line and not quite succeeding, and David faltering from side to side, what helps him come back to course, what helps him succeed at passing the kingship onwards, is that ability to reset. And that's why I think that when we pray for someone to redeem us, to redeem our broken world, to bring healing to us, to make what is broken whole again, who more appropriate to aspire for than someone who is by definition the son of, but also the imitator of, the kind of the, not imitator, someone who continues in the way of the man who was able to correct and fix and change for the better things time and time again. And on that note, I'm going to say goodbye, and may we be zocha, may we be privileged enough to see the revival of the Davidic spirit in its best, at its best within us, and the redemption. Thank you very much, and have a wonderful summer.
Thank you for this wonderful end to a wonderful series.
Thank you.
Very appreciate it. Really appreciate it. And thank you to everyone for coming. If you are interested in some more of the classes that are going on this week, I'm putting the link in the chat. And we hope to see you more this week. And thank you for coming. And thank you, big thank you again to Rachel Sharansky, Danziger Sharansky, for this wonderful, wonderful class. It was a really beautiful ending, honestly. I love the story of David every single time. And like this one was fantastic, like this way you told it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Orly. Goodbye, everyone. Have a wonderful day.
Toda rabba. Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. So inspiring.
Thank you. It was really my pleasure. It's always a pleasure to learn this story with people. It's
Maybe I will write to you my connection to your father.
Sure. I'll be happy to.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really did learn a lot from your class.
Thank you. I'm very honored. Thank you.
Please come back. Your class was wonderful, and I hope you do another series for us.
Thank you, Lauren. I'm in touch with Rabbi Kalman about that, and we're hoping to continue working together. So I'm sure he'll keep you posted.
Good.
Great. I heard your dad speak when I lived in Yerushalayim, and I was amazed not only by his insight but his sense of humor. You have good yichus there.
Thank you. Yeah, I cannot claim to have that sense of humor. As a kid, it was a very alarming sense of humor because he made jokes about everything all the time when we, the kids, wanted him to be serious. But I have to say, as an adult, I see that it gives me a certain resilience, the ability to laugh at things. So I'm grateful for it. Thank you for sharing it with me.